It is Saturday, December 11th, 2010, 10:06 a.m. on the Central Coast of California. Today on Geek Speak, Geek News, and the second half, your questions and comments about technology. The bandwidth for geekspeak.org is provided by GNI, gnihosting.com. It's time now for Geek Speak. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gap between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP. In the second half of the show, we'll be inviting you to join us via phone with questions and comments about technology. The phone numbers are 800-655-5877. Again, that's 800-655-5877. I'll give out that contact information again when I invite you to participation in about 25 minutes. GeekSpeak on KUSP is supported by Home and Small Business Tech, providing IT support to businesses, tech support for home computers. Home and Business Tech specializes in protecting data and have been providing data storage, recovery, virtualization, and maintenance for over 10 years. HASBTech.com. The theme song today is by Dave Portera. Thank you so much for producing that. If you'd like to make a theme song for GeekSpeak, we'd love to have it. GeekSpeak is a Creative Commons endeavor, which means that you can use our content as long as you accredit us with its origination. And of course, we take... What?
With its origination?
I know.
Well, from its source.
That's what we're doing. Yeah, okay. I'm Lyle Troxell, and there with me is Miles Elam, a software engineer and political junkie. Good morning, Miles.
Good morning.
Let's start with you.
One thing I would like to announce, even though we're on a Saturday, so we're a little bit time shifted, but yesterday was the birthday of the very first programmer. Do you know who the first programmer is? Oh, come on.
No, I don't.
Ada Lovelace.
What did she do?
She worked with Charles Babbage on the Difference Engine, or basically he was building up the engine, and she was looking at ways, this is before a working computer, mind you, but working at ways to basically make algorithms in times before the first computer. She is credited as being the first programmer.
Is this like in the 1800s somewhere?
Yes. She was born in 1815. There we go.
December 10th, which was yesterday?
Yes.
See, I knew that part. So first programmer, that's really cool. And I'm assuming this was, what did the Difference machine look like? A lot of gears?
Yes. It was very large. Well, in terms of very large, that's kind of a relative term. Compared to the ENIAC, it actually wasn't very large. But then again, that was the size of like multiple rooms. But it is large. It was taller than a person, and it was basically a small room sized and a whole bunch of gears and levers.
And what did the programming involve? Did it involve moving gears and such on screens?
It was, Babbage never actually made a working model that people would use.
Okay. So it was really a preliminary prototype kind of thing.
Yeah. So she was writing notes, a description of how it would be used. So, and these were notes that, you know, she had written down and were found many, many years, basically 100 years after her death.
Okay, so, but what about the Antitheria machine or Antithicia machine? Do you know what I'm talking about?
I have no idea what you're talking about.
So this is the oldest scientific computer. Supposedly it was made in 100 BC, and it was pulled up, it was unearthed in 1901, and it looks like it was in the Mediterranean. And basically, this is a machine that had a whole bunch of gears and mechanisms.
Oh,
do you know what I'm talking about?
Yes.
They had like x-rays of it because it's basically encased in rock.
Right. And it was used for navigation, wasn't it?
Yeah. Well, at first that was the thought, but it looks like it's just a celestial body calculator. So it tells you when you're going to have eclipses. And so it's basically an astrological device, which is really common for old high levels of math. Focused a lot about astral bodies. You know, figuring out the season, of course, is really important. Moon phase is, of course, great for syncing up community time clocks. And then people really seem to be enthralled with the idea that the moon can block the sun. And this is actually in the news recently because an Apple engineer recreated this ancient computer using Legos. So I've got a link up on the website of, let's see, it's the Andrew Carroll, he's one of the Apple software engineers, decided that he was going to go back to this device and recreate it completely in Legos. Now, he didn't get, not all the gears are exactly the same size, but he did the calculations. Basically, the way this machine works is it has something like 8 different blocks of gear sets, and each gear set does a multiplication, and then division to get the ratios necessary to actually calculate out the phases of the systems in our local bodies. Pretty cool. There's a great little video of it up on the GeekSpeak website if you'd like to see this gear thing by Legos in Legos.
Yes, work. But if you weren't already aware, this is where the programming language Ada gets its name.
Oh,
this is from Ada Lovelace.
Okay, I had heard that language before. All right, cool. Well, thank you, Miles. We did two on top of each other, totally related and unplanned. Ah, so nice. And now we'll go to Miles.
This one is actually a follow-up on a story we did last week, but people wouldn't know about it because we don't have a recording of it.
Yeah, let me cover that a little bit. So last week, we were in the Santa Cruz Holiday Parade. Last year, we did a great job. We're on the back of a flatbed truck provided by Theater Arts UCSC and drove through the parade broadcasting live. And the way we did the feed is we had a Sprint wireless device card connected to my laptop and doing a feed, and we had a backup of my iPhone. And this year, we did the exact same thing. Last year's show, fantastic. You can go listen to it on air. And if you go visit the show page, you can see a whole video of us, a time-lapse video of it. It was a great experience. This year, the trouble started when it started to rain. But additionally, we were definitely having some kind of cell dropout problems with Sprint through the parade. It basically cuts out regularly, like a cell phone conversation fail. And I believe it's because we were using more than one Sprint Wi-Fi point in the van. Like in the truck, we were using a couple of them. And that was kind of a shame. So the recording's bad. I didn't do a backup local recording. The entire thing broadcast, people were listening to it.
Yeah, I thought you were recording on your laptop at the time.
You know, I didn't. We had so much technical problems with the rain. It was so difficult to get everything running. I remember at one point I realized that all the bag of equipment that was spare was getting dripped on, and I spent 5 minutes trying to get that stuff cleared out.
So let this be a lesson to everyone. Even if you are technically savvy, it just means you make your problems that much more complex to guarantee failure.
That's right. So the backup is the feeling of the day. If I had just done a local recording, we would have a great recording of that show because it did sound great to us. End of the Pacific Garden.
Although there were some young folks that were behind our truck that were covering their ears and right next to the speakers and were not quite as happy with our show as we were.
Well,
sorry about that.
Oh, well.
So one of the stories that we covered was that NASA made an announcement about arsenic-based life. In other words, replacing arsenic with replacing phosphorus with arsenic in the formation of the DNA molecule. Well, some folks have been looking at that claim.
Meaning that the organism actually wouldn't use phosphorus anymore, which is part of the mechanism.
Right.
To create
cells. Their announcement was saying that it could, but if it wasn't available, that they would be able to do a backup to arsenic.
Okay. Which basically the story is exciting because it's possible that even in a very drastically different environment where arsenic was predominant and phosphorus wasn't, you could theoretically still have life forms.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of cool.
Right. Unfortunately, it doesn't seem to be holding up water. There's a lot of folks that are coming up saying, not so much. I think you guys jumped the gun. Other people who have backgrounds in biochemistry and like have gone back and looked at it and found, wait a second, the area that you're looking at, yes, it's low on phosphorus, and so phosphate would have been harder to manage, but there are other places that have just as low or lower that we see phosphorus-based DNA or phosphate-based DNA. And then looking at the arsenic and going, well, we have other areas that have high levels of arsenic too, where the organisms are able to compensate, and through various testing and seeing, testing solubility versus non-solubility, basically an arsenic-based molecule would dissolve in a saline solution,
mm-hmm.
Whereas the phosphorus wouldn't. That's one of the great things about the way DNA is made right now is that it isn't water soluble because that wouldn't.
Well, and there's some concepts of how early organisms swap DNA. It wasn't by mating. It wasn't just by cell division. It was that free spans of DNA were floating around, and they just combine, and you get new organism potentially.
But
I mean, it's more complicated than that.
But what they were finding was, no, it was this organism is not based upon DNA. It merely is highly tolerant to. I'm sorry, it isn't made from arsenic in their DNA, but it is highly tolerant to arsenic in the environment. But they're still making phosphates. DNA chains based upon phosphates.
Ah, bummer. All right. Well, here's something completely creepy.
And now for something completely different.
So this guy, sorry to explain, this professor decided that he's going to install a camera in the back of his head. So surgically implanted a camera in the back of his head. And unfortunately, there's a video of this.
Wait, so he can spy on his class and make sure they aren't doing anything bad? What's the rationale here?
You know, you're asking for rationale when someone installs a camera in the back of your head. It doesn't matter what the rationale is. I mean, don't do that.
No. I know a few nuns out there in Catholic school that would love this device to be able to see in the back of their head. Actually, you know what? There are probably some of them that have it already installed, according to some people I've known who went to Catholic school.
What he actually installed was a mounting plate, a titanium plate, which I'm assuming inside has a ferrous magnet. But basically, that'll be under the skin, and then he'll be able to attach a camera mounting to it. So it's really just a mount point, like a really expensive head tripod, head pod. Anyway, so that's all he's done. But his rationale, I'm assuming, just to be more technically available. And there's some cool body modifications. We covered years ago the idea of putting very small magnets inside a silicone bead inside your finger. And what happens is as you get sensation around something over and over again, your body starts to figure out what that sensation's about. And if you have a little magnet that actually spins and has like an egg shape to it, you can detect magnetic fields as you move your hand around them. And you can get actually pretty good at this. That's one I want. And then there's, of course, the tattoo display.
That way you can do navigation without looking at a...
I know. It's constantly when I'm picking up cables, I'm like, is this hot or not? And you know. It's cool. All right, Miles, your turn.
Google has released their first laptop or netbook. They're calling it the CR48. It runs Chrome OS.
What's Chrome OS?
Chrome OS is an operating system. It's based upon Linux. So in that way, it's like Android. But the idea behind this laptop is it has no local storage for user programs. Everything you use is going to be web-based. They have a Linux-based OS that has, you know, a GUI, and then you have a modified version of the Chrome browser to make it look like, you know, your
browser, right?
Yeah.
So does this mean that you originally...
Well, it makes it look like your desktop, actually, was what I was going to say.
So when you're, quote, logging into this laptop, you're actually logging into some web service that has all your content? So
yes.
It's like a remote login all the time.
Yes.
So these laptops are completely
cloud-based.
Ubiquitous kind of thing. That's pretty cool. So you and I could both have one. We could swap them. It wouldn't matter.
Right.
The data is completely separate.
Exactly. And one of the ideas behind it also is security-wise, you don't have to worry about viruses as much because, one, you're in a browser environment, so they don't. You're not installing anything ever onto your main system. And assuming this was your main system. And it doesn't... So it doesn't allow for it to be compromised. However, if there is a browser compromise, it could get onto the system. But at the same time, all you would have to do is when the system detects a signature change, there is some DRM in there in the system. It doesn't stop you from installing another operating system, but it does allow for signatures. And what
signatures
that would
basically
do,
encrypting or doing a hash encryption. It's hard to explain this, but basically fingerprinting the code that's on your machine.
It's a great way of saying it. It's a fingerprint. And if the fingerprint doesn't match, it knows your system's been compromised.
It will
prompt the user to say, hey, do you want to refresh this
bring
from...
Bring it back to default or whatever.
Yeah, bring it back to default.
Now, this machine, I'm assuming, has a lot of RAM and some kind of ROM storage, some kind of flash storage just for the operating system itself. So there's no hard drive on it. There wouldn't be a need for it.
I don't know about a lot of RAM. I mean, how much you really need for that browser. I've had...
Well, if you're doing flash content and you know, streaming YouTube videos,
you'd be surprised what 1 gig of RAM can do for you.
Yeah. Well, so this would not be a great solution for editing video, editing audio.
It does have a webcam, but yeah.
But you can't take pictures with it.
Well, you
I guess
would,
you can.
But
you just,
I mean, if you have flash, you can.
You got
right
some
there.
Storage. You got some temporary cache, basically.
But it's a 12-inch LCD. It's just under 4 pounds. Boots in about 10 seconds.
Right. Of course. Nice
because
and fast.
It's a
browser.
You know, it's just a base operating system with a browser on it.
Yeah, I could get into using that. I mean, it's very much like, I mean, in the functionality, it's very similar to the iPad.
It's what most people are using netbooks for anyway.
Yeah, it's true. It's true.
You're not using netbooks for video editing. You're not using netbooks for hardcore gaming.
And I got to say that I've been using, I run a Macintosh environment, and my laptop in front of me, which is a Power Mac, MacBook Pro, excuse me. I have, you know, Apple Mail, and I use IMAP, so my content's all in the cloud, but I cache it aggressively, basically. And that application is not as good to use as Gmail's application. Like, even when you're disconnected from the network, when you boot up Chrome, I use Chrome for my Gmail and Safari, they both work great. When I start up the browser, even without any network, I still see my older mail. Like, everything's cached anyway. Mm-hmm. It's kind of amazing.
And so HTML5 local storage.
Right, which I'm assuming this takes aggressive use of, so that your mail and your web services are very snappy, really quick.
Well, I don't know. I don't know about that. We don't have one in-house, so don't know for sure.
Hint.
It also comes with both Wi-Fi and 3G. So there may be an assumption that you always have connectivity, but I don't know.
Right. Yeah, you'd have to. I mean, the thing is, you can't use it that reliably, right? Especially if you and I are passing back and forth
laptops. That's true, and having it locally is always going to be that much faster.
And you also can't do authentication off of, you know, if I pick up your laptop and I want to start using it, and really it has to connect to the cloud to get credential verification, then we're not going to use it right away. And you can't trust the cache because you want to make it secure as well. Anyway, going on, we kind of went into the rabbit hole in that one, didn't we? Soon we'll be asking you to call us with questions and comments so we can sound a little less technical. But I do want to cover an interesting story. Speaking of small computers, this team at Berkeley EECS, Electrical Engineering and Computer Science Department, has created a piece of software that runs on their robot platform that uses the Kinect sensor, the Microsoft Kinect sensor, which is this this sensor we've talked about before on the show. It's in the new Xbox.
The ability
Kinect.
To do a whole bunch of hand waving and actually have it do something.
Dance in front of a game without holding any controller, and it actually knows what you're doing.
Which is sad. We'll never be able to say, yeah, a whole bunch of hand waving, and then wait, but that's actually useful.
The way this, quote, sensor works is it actually has a camera in it, but it also has a some kind of laser device that prints out a whole bunch of dots in the environment. So if you look at it with a camera that can see infrared, which almost all CCD cameras can, you see a giant cloud of dots. And it knows it has two cameras in it. And it basically sees the differentiation of the two dots. And by looking at those dots, it can determine how close that dot is. So if you stand in front of it, it kind of gives you it produces three-dimensional images. It's a 3D scanner, basically, a real-time 3D scanner.
It's not just testing to see how long the light takes to get back to the
sensor. You know, I don't think so. I think that's actually a lot harder to do.
Well, yeah.
Because you're talking about really fast. I mean, that kind of light travels pretty quickly. I don't know if you know.
Well, it's just 186,000 kilometers per second.
300 kilometers. Yeah, exactly.
Or 300 kilometers per second.
300 kilometers per second.
Yeah. I was thinking 100. I was thinking miles.
Don't do that.
Miles? Yeah, I need to stop doing that. It's so much easier. 300,000.
Because you understand what 100,000 miles is. No. All right. In any case, this platform that they have is one of those flying platforms that has a whole bunch of helicopter blades. We've seen these in research before. You basically have a really stable flying platform. And this thing has this Kinect sensor on top of it, and it can look in front of it and determine if it can fly forward or not just off of this sensor. So more automation, ability to dissect the environment. You could see in future systems, these being in front of vehicles to determine where things are. It has a backup traditional sightseeing system as well that robots have been using for a while, just in case this thing drops out. But the Kinect sensor, it's light enough. Now, to use the processing power, they've got a 1.6 gigahertz Intel Atom-based computer on there running Ubuntu 10.04. So it's a full computer robot brain.
Yeah, whatever. My netbook has a 1.6 gigahertz Atom processor.
So. Yeah, but is it detecting objects in space and flying? Yeah, I didn't think so.
It is flying when my dog misbehaves.
Moving on. What's up next for you, sir?
It wouldn't be Geek Speak, and it wouldn't be me without political news. We're going to go a little less U.S.-centric for a while and start talking about about Canada, our neighbors to the north.
Wait. You said we're going to be less U.S.-centric. Oh, that's right. It's not part of the U.S. Go ahead.
Yes, Canada.
You're talking about our hat, right?
Yeah, the U.S.'s largest national park. No, sorry.
You know that we have a lot of podcast listeners, right? And they're all the Canadians are all going, guys, come on. All right, what's the story about?
Oh, geez. So the Canadian Supreme Court is going to decide if linking is the same as publishing.
Linking? Like, as linking. In web linking, making a link to something?
Yeah, making a link to something. Whether or not, you know, linking to someone, especially the concept that has come about, not from a technical standpoint, but rather from a social standpoint of deep linking, linking to a specific article and not going mm-hmm. to a homepage.
Is equivalent to publishing?
That's the question.
Wait, I don't understand. So if right now on the GeekSpeak website, we have all these news stories we cover, and every week we take those news stories and we put them on the show page for the day so that people can read more about what we're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And in those, we do a little synopsis. Normally, we actually copy their intro paragraph, put the title of whatever we want to say, like Apple Engineer Recreates Ancient Computer with Legos is the one mm-hmm. that I covered a while ago, and the link right to their story about it on that case on CNET. And the question is, am I republishing them because I linked to them?
That is pretty much the question, yeah.
Is this based off of a lawsuit? I mean, it seems a little strange in the sense that clearly I'm not recreating the content.
Yes, this is based upon a suit because mm-hmm. that's the only way you can get to a Supreme
right.
Court in Canada and in the U.S. But at the same time, it's one that doesn't, it basically ignores the technology. It's kind of like someone saying, hey, let me take this technology. Where's this fundamental aspect to it? All right, let me change it so that it's completely cripples that technology. Because frankly, if you take away hyperlinking in the way that it's been used, you have destroyed that which made the web popular in the first place.
Right. Hyperlinking specifically is creating a universal reference link to another location. And that's
uniform
how the web works.
Uniform resource locator.
Thank you.
But at the same time, everyone has seen this before. You go to a web page, you have the little phrases or words that are in blue and underlined.
That you click on. Anything right. you click on, basically, is one of these.
Right.
But I don't understand. You're not creating the you're not republishing the content. You're telling where the content is. It's equivalent to publishing an address of where the library is to get a book. It's not the same thing. So this is the case, and it's actually gone to the Supreme Court in Canada?
Yes.
It doesn't make any – we're missing something, clearly. It just doesn't make any sense. It's frustrating me. Miles is looking through the story going, well, are we? I mean, I can kind of see what you're talking about. If you're deep linking to something, to some degree, the knowledge of how to get to the article, it's not something like you can...
Okay, I got a little bit more information here.
Okay.
It's a defamation suit.
Interesting.
And someone linking to a person...
To some article something that somebody said.
Right.
Okay.
And so can that link, if you put it someplace very popular...
Can it be similar to defamation in the sense that it was published? So if I say something like, Miles is a complete slob, and you want to sue me for defamation of character, instead, if I say, Miles is a... and link to an article that talks about you being a slob, the question, am I doing the same thing? That sounds like what the case is about.
Yeah.
Because you can find anybody.
By linking to defamatory articles, this person becomes a publisher of that material.
That seems similar to the idea of a search engine providing links to content that's potentially illegal, and then them being liable for that illegal content. Same similar type of issue,
right? And
which is pretty common in legal systems. Like if you're the body that allows people to get to the bad stuff. In this case, defamation of character, then aren't you responsible for that?
Yeah, but it's also a lot closer to, a good analogy would be a footnote.
Yeah.
So you have, you know, some statement that you put in there, and you have your little footnote, your reference point to the bibliography, to the original source.
Sure.
So you're not actually saying it, you're referencing what someone else said. So if you put that into an academic paper, for example, and say, here's my reference, here's my source, for that I didn't say this originally, someone else did, and here's where you can read more about it.
Right.
Does that mean that because you have that as a footnote that you are liable? And
well, I mean, defamation laws are very strange for
but
US
that's
people.
That question also of, is the rule going to be the same for the real, I mean, when I say the real world, I mean the published world.
Well, let me ask you this.
Or
if,
the paper world
an alleyway in a city, there was a whole bunch of defamation written all over the place, and then I go there with a megaphone on the street and say, hey, everybody, go down this aisle and look what's written there. Even if I didn't write it, I'm allowing for more people to see that character defamation, right? So potentially I'm liable for the instances where those people see it.
Yeah. But and here's one that's brought up in the case. If two friends are walking past a sign with defamatory statements on it and one friend points it out to the other, the law should not make the friend who points out to the sign liable as a publisher of defamatory statements
okay,
on that
I
sign.
I agree to that, but what if I'm writing for a newspaper and I have thousands of people reading me and then I say, "Hey, take a look at this." Isn't that a little different than talking to a friend? Because now you're using your publishing power to produce more awareness of this.
Yeah, see, now you're getting into a slippery slope.
What happens
if you're in a group of 100 people, you're off on a conference or whatever, and one person points out the sign? Is it because of the volume of people that suddenly it becomes more intense? That becomes and then how many people?
Yeah, and I get that, but there are different rules within publishing versus when walking.
And what happens
public?
If you have a newspaper where someone writes that and there are only 10 readers?
Fascinating things. Things to ponder here on GeekSpeak. You're listening to GeekSpeak. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air with me is Miles Elam. We're going to be now taking your calls, questions, and comments about technology. I'll give out the phone number in just a second. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP. As the Geek Bit today is a video made from a RC plane flying around the New York City. It goes around the Statue of Liberty. It flies around the Brooklyn Bridge, and it's got a high-def camera, and there's a YouTube video of it, and I'm linking to it from the GeekSpeak website right now. A beautiful, beautiful video from a perspective you've never seen before. And the police were curious about it and came and take a look, and as soon as people were real professional about it and the police were professional about it, in fact, there's a bit in the video mixed in where this plane is flying and seeing the police, and the police are like waving to it, which is kind of cool. And the TSA police and the TSA were both professional, or so the creators of this video say, and they're very clear that this is not something you should do unless you really know what you're doing. It takes a lot of skill. And the way they did this is they had two cameras on it. They had a high-def camera that was picking up the actual scene they were filming, and then a low-def camera that was being fed back via wireless to the operator. So the operator was looking through this camera to actually fly the plane. Pretty awesome video. I highly recommend seeing
it. Is it as cool as the 400 mile per hour plane?
Oh, yeah. No, it's much better than that. The 400 mile per hour plane is just like you're standing on the ground, you're looking at the clouds, and all of a sudden, phew, a little airplane flies by. This one, you're flying around New York City in this really cool way. And you're kind of like, don't bump into the Statue of Liberty. Okay, good. It's pretty neat. You're listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP. We're taking your calls with questions and comments about technology. The phone numbers are 800-655-5877. Again, that's 1-800-655-5877. That's toll-free, of course, so anyone can call for free, and Rick will answer the phone, and we'll take your questions or comments on the air. Again, that's 1-800-655-5877. Toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. And we will take any calls today. But while we're waiting for those calls, Mr. Miles Elam, what's up next?
I'm going to continue on my political kick and just take a pot shot at the website known as UCUT. This is something put up by the Republican leadership. And the idea is actually an interesting one, a good one, to say, here's the budget. Now, popular vote, people come on there and want you to cut different programs. Like
Decide
what you don't want the most.
Who's writing the content to describe the programs? Because, of course, that's the vital piece of information.
There's that, too.
Like, the medical thing is, let soldiers die, and you have to say yes to that. I mean,
right.
You never know how the phrasing happens. Yeah.
But at the same time, it's coming under fire from the National Science Foundation, who gets a lot of their budget from, or they do get their budget from Congress, where the public does not have the background
right.
to be able to decide what one particular program is more valuable, one particular program is more valuable than another. An example of this would be Governor Mark Sanford of South Carolina, who once talked about talking about all of the excess of having the government funding of studies of ATMs. Now, most people, I'm sure, when they're listening to this, would think, oh, ATMs, why are you looking at ATMs? Like, you get money out of them, they're pretty much a solved problem, and the private sector is taking care of that. Except they weren't talking about automated teller machines. They were talking about a network technology known as asynchronous transfer mode, high-speed interconnects, which are very important to know about research so that the internet can grow and people can continue to get wonderful podcasts like ours.
What you're saying is that when the research is being talked about and done, there's no practical use for it. Everybody now thinks ATM machines are awesome. But when the technology was being developed to produce those, it was just a weird descriptor that no one would understand.
Also, imagine this. Someone says, well, why do we have people going out and taking scrapings, you know, by the seashore and like doing analysis on this like seagull poop? Like, what is this? Well, it turns out that AZT, one of the first effective anti-AIDS medicines, had a chemical in it that was present in seagull sperm. And how did you find that? Is you go out and you do
you do analysis.
Well, you take everything out there, you start writing it up, and you know,
and
see.
And the reason why representative democracy exists is because not everyone should be spending the time and effort necessary to understand every detail to decide how society should work. So instead you say, let's get some people that we believe and have faith in to then do all that work, and they will represent us in our democracy. And that's right. The basic idea. And so what they're doing by saying, popular vote, you run the government, goes to a space of, well, how are you going to ensure that everyone that votes is thinking intelligently about everything?
Yeah.
Of course, the counter to that is, are any politicians thinking about this anyway?
Aside from issues of tyranny of the majority, this is not to say that, yes, National Science Foundation should get carte blanche, or any organization out there should get government funding without any oversight or looking into what they're doing. It's just a question of this faux populism going on, saying, hey, you decide what we're going to cut and then we'll go, is just a little disingenuous and frankly a little scary about where we're going, where someone who has dedicated their life to a subject, you know, a scientist, someone who's a PhD in science has in a particular field, is in their late 20s at the earliest, and usually much older, and has dedicated their life to studying this particular one area and is pushing the limits of human knowledge, that their opinion would be on the same level as someone who looked at a website, saw a one-liner, and then made a snap decision. Like, that's where the disconnect seems to come in.
Yeah, definitely. All right, well, I hope that, I see the shortcomings of this quite clearly, but I also, I'm a sci-fi lover, and there are some ideas of societies that operate where voting and basically democracy operates at a faster and more efficient level by everyone having cool technology tools, right? So
communication tools.
And it's always excited me. But the only way that system works is if you have a very educated populace. And right now, I don't have a lot of faith in the populace to be aware that you need to have people spending time looking at seagull feces. You know, that's just not something I think everyone feels is important. All right, we got some calls coming in. Let's go ahead and take the first one from Santa Cruz. I need some music. All right, great, thank you. Kelly from Santa Cruz, welcome to Geek Speak.
Hey, interesting conversation there about democracy. I heard something the other day when Bernie Sanders was on C-SPAN ranting on. He said 75% of the recruits in the Army were disqualified, either due to weight, lack of intelligence, or criminal record. So that means only 25%. Anyway, you get the idea. Not very many people even qualify for the Army. That's why they have PhDs now, supposedly going into the Army.
Wow.
Anyway, we're scraping the bottom of the barrel, guys.
What's your question?
The question I had was, have you ever heard of remote neural monitoring?
No.
It's on the web. You've got to check it out. It's been there for 10 or 15 years. It supposedly, pick up every brain, puts out a signature wave, unique, just like a thumbprint.
Mm-hmm.
And they claim that they can pick up that signal and basically watch your activities at a distance. I don't know exactly the whole thing, but I've read about it.
I know the stuff you're talking about now. Yeah, there's a lot
it's out there on the web. There's a lot of information now.
There's stuff about how tasty toe fungus is as well on the web. Having it on the web has no
I understand, but then you go to places
right,
like
so what I would say about this
freedom or mind freedom, and they claim it's real. The Russians claim
what
it's
I would say is this a few different things. First off, there of course is a lot of electromagnetic stuff happening inside the brain. That's how the cells are actually talking to each other, right? So there is stuff going on there, but you have a thick skull and you have tissue above that and below that, and to get signal stuff out of the brain at a distance, further it is,
you can get signal information.
Yeah,
but what you're talking about is tracking what
an individual is.
An
individual, let's say.
Yeah.
Yeah. I would say that, let's put it this way. There's a lot more data coming from your heart than your brain in the sense of where you are, right? The heart is actually produces sound outside the body. The brain does not. And sound waves actually travel pretty well through air. So picking up a location of someone based off of their heartbeat is probably going to be easier than from their brain waves. Brain waves are just not that strong. You got to think about the efficiency of the system.
No, I hear you. What about, shadowing, microwave shadowing, whatever, you can bounce off and, get
Yeah, I mean, you can do that kind of stuff with tissue, but to try to find an actual person, we don't have like some of these websites are talking about how you can do this from satellite. And I'm going to say, no way can you do this from satellite. Star Trek Enterprise can do that. We can't. This is very, very complicated stuff. There's no way that there's enough signal coming from the human brain. I would say they would probably be almost impossible to detect it from 15 feet away. There's
okay,
just nothing
so
there.
We're saying electromagnetic spectrum, we can't detect
you,
it.
Well, we can. Just, it's we just can. That you have
so much noise.
Imagine, for example, that your brain is this LED flashlight.
Mm-hmm.
And if you are right up next to it, sure, you can see that very well. But what happens if you have a bright, sunny day? And that person goes 50 feet away from you. Can you really see the light of that LED flashlight?
What about using Whitaker signals or Whitaker, whatever? You've probably heard of that.
What I'm saying is it's probably not something that's a feasibility. It doesn't make any sense. But let me just say that I haven't researched this thoroughly, but let me just say a couple things about that. I have, additionally, most of these websites also talk about tracking the people and also thinking about finding out what they're thinking and what they're doing. And this kind of idea definitely leads to wearing a tinfoil hat, which is one of those things we joke about as in a society as the person that's lost their mind. But the truth is, yes, it is feasible that to detect stuff remotely. We know about that. But to actually find out what's happening in the human brain, not so much. Now, there are commercial products that allow to attach to the skull. And with these devices, and I've used them in art research, you put it on your head and theoretically you think a certain way to get a baseline and then you train it over and over again to be able to have four or five different direction sense. So over a period of a few hours, you can train this system to know when you're thinking up, down, left, and right. And doing that is extremely hard. It's doing a lot of analysis. The brain is not like a very simple thing to understand.
No, well, so understood. And
what I'm saying is, yeah, that's touching the scalp because the signals are just not very strong. Even touching the scalp, trying to figure out what a person's thinking is not something we can do. And then there's, of course, MRIs where you actually put the person inside of strong magnetic resonance chamber, basically, and detect the changes that happen in the brain, which basically is adding a whole bunch more power into the system to be able to detect what's happening.
Right, I understand. That's
so
like shadowing.
So when I saw from Rick your story coming up, on this thing, I looked at just a Google search on remote neural monitoring and saw like the first 50 hits are all about websites saying they can read your brains remotely. There's so much other junk involved in it that the whole field seems to be probably not
suspect.
Exactly. That's my thought.
I found this about 8-9 years ago, supposedly Russian scientist. There's a place called Mind Freedom.
Yeah. See, this is the stuff, Kelly, I'm going to have to say goodbye because we could talk about this kind of stuff forever, and we wouldn't get any further.
One last question. What about the non-local communication, since we do have quantum stuff now? I'll get off.
Bye, Kelly. All right, let's move on to Francis and Carmel. Carmel?
How are you?
Hi.
I'm not a geek, but I have a laptop that's running XP, and I use Chrome as a browser.
Mm-hmm.
And when I turn it on, it takes forever to start up.
The laptop or the browser?
Improve that startup time.
The laptop or the browser?
The whole thing.
The whole computer, when it's off completely to turn it on.
Yes.
Yeah. How long is forever?
Well, I haven't timed it, but I would say 7 minutes.
7 minutes. Yeah, that's something's wrong. Has this machine always done this, or is it a more recent thing?
It's done it off and on. And
when a machine is running really slow, the first thing I think is bad hard drive.
Mm-hmm. And that's my thought, too.
And the reason is that a hard drive, we'd like to think that they're nice and stable and strong and reliable. But in reality, what's happening is that the storage makers that make hard drives are trying to cram as much data as possible in there. And so what they do is they say, well, if we make it this dense, this data storage this dense, it won't be very reliable. And they say, well, if it's not very reliable, let's say every third time you read it, you get the right answer. Well, we'll just read it 15 times and average it, and then it'll be okay. Of course, every time it has a problem, it goes and reads it again and reads it again and reads it again. And when hard drives start to fail, what you'll see is the system slows way down because the computer will just keep trying and trying and trying until it finally does. It doesn't care if it has to try 1,000 times. It will. And then you get in a situation where your machine is running extremely slow. And sometimes so
even, even though you do a defrag and it says, oh, things are fine.
Yeah, it's not a software problem. It's a hardware problem. So defragging is merely reorganizing items so that you can get to them faster. It's kind of like going to the library and they get the card catalog so everything's in order so you can find stuff. But it doesn't help you if the cards, you know, get wet.
Yeah. Yeah, basically we're talking, in the analogy of like in the room, in the other room here, there's a whole bunch of vinyl records. And the vinyl records are all by specific music genre and then by alphabetical by the artist's name. And that's a pretty efficient way to store the system. If I run in here and I want to put a record away, I might put it down at the bottom right. And then over the period of time, the thing will get completely unorganized. So what a defrag does basically is resort that entire shelf of vinyl. But if the vinyl is scratched, then who cares if it's resorted, right? You're still going to listen to it, and it's still going to sound like it's bad. Of course, all our vinyl at KOSP sounds beautiful.
Right, and a hard drive ends up being very much like that vinyl record where there's a scratch, so it goes, and then every once in a while it'll come back again.
What's that?
Is it worthwhile and easy to replace the hard drive?
So that's the thing is, when I started saying this, is that it sounds like a hard drive thing. It might not be. It could be something else wrong with your computer. So to replace the hard drive is kind of a shot in the dark. How old is your computer? And it's a laptop?
5-year laptop.
Yeah, 5-year old laptop. Yeah, replacing the hard drive is not going to be a bad thing for you at all. It definitely would improve the system performance, especially if you normally plug in your laptop, you don't find yourself using it via battery power. When you get it...
Plugged in, but it goes through the battery, doesn't
right,
it?
Right, right. But if you spend most of your time with your laptop plugged in, which a lot of people do, then then losing some battery performance is not a bad sacrifice. And the reason I mention it is that there's two different types of hard drives, basically, spinning hard drives. There's a 500 hard drive that spins at 500 RPM, right?
5400 or 7200,
Or 7200. And basically, the speed at which the hard drive spins is denotes how fast the data can come off it. So right now, you most likely have a 5400 RPM hard drive for your laptop. If you get a 7200 RPM for your laptop, it will increase the speed. Even if the laptop hard drive is not the problem, it'll increase the speed. But it uses more energy, so your battery life is not going to be as good. But if you normally spend time plugging in, go ahead and get a 7200 RPM. Now, in this situation, because it's a laptop, I would take it to somebody that does this because opening up a laptop is never easy.
Well, except for the new Macs. I just replaced my hard drive.
Well, that's the brand new ones, though. Yeah. That's totally different. Yeah, but
I replaced the battery. The RAM, that was easy.
The RAM is normally easier than the hard drive, yeah.
Yeah.
All right, well, thank you so much for the call.
Thank you.
Take care. Bye. We are taking calls with questions and comments about technology. The phone numbers are 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877.
I often wonder, actually, when someone talks about that, whether or not it would be more cost-effective to just buy a new laptop. It's sad to say, but into like support costs and getting the hard drive and
having it installed. Because from a hard drive perspective, it's pretty cheap. But then again, I do the hard drive replacement myself. I mean, that's not the cost. The cost
exactly.
is to get somebody to do it for you. So we're talking about probably $200 or $300 to get a new hard drive in there, only because of the cost.
Right,
of
even though the hard drive only costs like $60.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Interesting. All right, from Mountain View, Kieran, welcome.
Hi, it's actually pronounced Kieran.
Kieran, hi, welcome
to Irish spelling.
All right.
Well, I have a question about my iPod.
Okay.
I got it from my dad. It's the second iPod made by Apple, and I'm wondering how it's possible that the hard drive has failed yet.
You're very kind to it. When you say it's the second iPod, it's got it does have a laptop hard drive in it. Are you sure that it, I mean, is there a spinning drive in it? That's the thing, is that even the early laptop, it does?
Whenever I turn on, I can hear the drive spinning, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, those early
How
ones.
How has it not was, failed? Yeah,
it was unmistakable.
And the battery failed
there.
Already, and Apple doesn't even carry, like, chargers for it anymore because it's so old.
Yeah.
Yeah, you got lucky.
You've gotten lucky, yeah. Make sure you have backups of your music. I mean, the thing is, it will fail eventually if it keeps being used. The other thing is the laptop hard drives have a really great feature in them that when it detects a sudden movement, it pulls the head out of the way of the platter. So it actually moves the head away. So that's necessary for a small device like that.
Also, I mean, most hard drives, just like RAM, will fail in the first like 30 days,
right?
Something like that. If they're going to fail, they would fail in that time. And then you have another jump out point to 5 years or so. Mm-hmm. That's when they'll start to fail again. But you always have outliers. You always have the hard drive that, you know, has been, that you've had for 15 years that still goes, even though it's so small, it's not useful anymore.
I remember some story about a light bulb that's over 100 years old running 24 hours a day.
Which they also have at a very low power. They're not running it at the intensities that we want for normal illumination.
The iPod, also, the other thing is the operating system, the actual control mechanisms of the drive are not on the hard of the system, are not on the hard drive. They're actually in flash RAM. They're in some kind of RAM or some kind of ROM on the machine. And because of that, as you start up your drive and you're using the operating system, all that stuff, you're not, the iPod, you're not using the hard drive. The only time you use the hard drive is actually when you start playing music. And it's not going to be doing that kind of rapid search and seek thing that a hard drive on a computer does. It's going to do it sequentially. One song, short period of time, then it's going to go to the next song. It's going to jump when it does those song changes. Mm. But other than that, it's a nice, stable, sequential read.
And very slow.
And very, very slow compared to a normal hard drive in a laptop. You don't need the kind of speeds off this thing you normally need.
Is that why whenever, like, I'm running or something and listening to music on it, when my iPod bounces, like, cuts out?
When it bounces?
Yeah, like, if I'm running and the iPod is bouncing, like, in my pocket, music like cuts out every few seconds.
Yeah, that's actually exactly the detection of when the hard drive detects a gyroscopic movement of enough intensity, it will pull the reading heads away from the platters. This is equivalent.
Wait, is it gyroscopic? I thought it was just sheer G-force.
I only say gyroscopic because it's a small gyroscopic thing that detects it.
This iPod, it's like the one of the ones that has the lock on the top, and when you touch any button, automatically starts up, but otherwise
right.
It doesn't.
Right. Let's put it this way. The fact that you go jogging with it, are extremely lucky that it is still working after so long.
I would say that Apple did a thing where they're not running that hard drive very fast, and they're being extremely careful with it.
There's.
I know, it's amazing, isn't it? I love it.
You're at the top end of that bell-shaped curve, and enjoy the ride.
And of course, the battery failed on it. Did you replace the battery?
No, I just keep it plugged in. When I use it, sometimes I plug it in overnight and it will work for a quick jog without being plugged in. Like right now, holding it and it's not plugged in and it's working.
Thank you so much. Thanks so much for calling. Can I ask how old you are?
I'm 12.
Thank you so much for calling and listening to Geek Speak.
Okay.
Take
Goodbye.
Care. Bye bye. Other reasons why computers don't start up quickly. Somebody called in, PB, maybe Preston Boomer, I don't know, from Santa Cruz called in, to say that, mentioned that about Trojans and viruses can definitely slow down a machine. And that's true.
And antivirus software can slow down a machine.
Totally true. And the thing is, with a 7-minute boot up time on a laptop, the boot up time, it's possible there's a Trojan inside the BIOS, but probably not.
That early on?
It's basically the startup time. You're not going to see the viruses start to run until the system's up and running. And you're basically going to have Windows running. That time frame when you have a desktop and then nothing happens for a long time, I would say that's the space where you're looking at Trojans. But who knows?
Or the antivirus software that's meant to fight Trojans.
Yeah.
Or viruses, rather.
All right. Let's do one more news story, and I think we're going to be done with the show today. You got one more?
Sure, and this one could even function kind of like a geek bit, which is anyone who has played like the Quake type of games, especially Quake 3 and its progeny, are familiar with the concept of a railgun. A railgun being that you don't have anything like gunpowder or anything like that to get your projectile going. The idea is you have a projectile and that's what a bullet is you have a whole bunch of accelerant, in this case gunpowder,
right.
And you have a mass in front of that accelerant so that when it explodes, it launches
the shrapnel bullet. Basically from the explosion. Hmm.
Whereas a railgun doesn't have that chemical process. It uses an electromagnet.
Or lots of electromagnets.
Right. You take something that is magnetic, something that would respond to
Or conductive. But go on.
Right. And then you have a series of magnets that, imagine you have a magnet and you're pulling a paperclip along the table. That same concept of, except that you put it on for a split second, so the paperclip jumps a little bit.
If you've played with a paperclip and a magnet, and you kind of get the magnet, the paperclip close, and then you let it go, and it kind of flings quickly to the magnet, that force. If it's an electromagnet, you can turn it off and turn it back on. And so if you line up 100 magnets in a row, and you start it at the paperclip at one side, and you slowly turn them on so that you turn it off before it's gotten to it, it'll keep accelerating it. And this is a science fiction kind of thing. It's also, there's a potential to launch things off the planet with these railgun devices.
Well, you say it's a science fiction thing, except that the U.S. Navy
has been doing
successfully test fired a railgun.
I've seen
on Friday
the video of that. Amazing.
And they fired at they're able to go about 200 kilometers, fire 200 kilometers at 5 times the speed of sound.
That's really, really fast.
Yes.
I saw the fire of that thing without distance, just local, you know, firing it locally into like a slab of concrete, and the whole concrete exploded. It was insane.
Yes. And you throw something at something fast enough, you have interesting effects.
Geekspeech is a registered service mark of online delight with David Lawrence and is used with permission. We thank the Puppet Master for its use, that's for sure. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP Santa Cruz. We're streaming and podcasting at KUSP.org. All the stuff we talk about during this hour of GeekSpeak is available online at geekspeak.org. Miles Elam was the geek in the house with me today. Miles, thank you so much for being here today.
Always a pleasure.
And Rick was answering the phones. Thank you all for calling. Of course, all the content's available at geekspeak.org.